This is Robert Tidwell conducting an oral history interview with Michael Lewis O'Brien on the 13th of August, 2003, at approximately 10 after 8 o'clock in the morning. How are you this morning, Mr. O'Brien?
Doing very well, thank you.
Just to begin, what was your life like before you entered the Navy? How was your childhood? Where did you grow up?
I was born and reared in Metropolis, Illinois, which is down on almost the southern tip of the state. And I had what I would describe as a rather normal childhood. Looking at it retrospectively, we were very poor. However, at the time, I think our lifestyle was pretty much parallel with that of many other families.
So compared to others, you would say that it was a normal childhood then?
I do. Things were much different then, of course. We had no electricity, we had no running water in the house and that sort of thing, but then that was just generally true of everybody in those days.
So did you live outside of town?
No, we lived in town.
Oh, you lived in town. Okay. How large was that town at that time?
About 5,000 people.
That's fairly good size.
Uh-huh. But we lived on 9th Street, the corner of 9th at Fillmore. Both streets at our corner were graveled. Across the street from my house was an absolute empty block, just with weeds and bushes and that sort of thing growing on it. So it was somewhat of an austere existence, as, again, compared with today.
Did you have any siblings when you were growing up?
None.
Okay. Oh, so you were an only child.
I was an only child.
Did you have any relatives nearby, like cousins and aunts and uncles?
Oh, yeah, we had a multitude of them in nearby towns.
Oh, okay. So they weren't in the same town with you?
No.
Okay. So what sort of things did you do in your youth? Did you have jobs? Did you play any kind of sports?
I did. I played a little basketball, certainly far less than professional level. I was quite interested in music. My band director was a fellow named Bob Biggs. He was from Mississippi, and it was as a result of having had the experience with him as a fledgling musician that I later, after I got out of the Navy, went to college and became a music teacher myself, which I did for 42 years.
Outstanding. What sort of jobs did you have when you were younger?
I worked for the Natural Gas Company as a regulator control person, regulator tester and meter tester. And I also helped at installations of floor furnaces. And the reason for that was that many of the buildings in those days had very limited access to get under the floor. And I was small enough to do that, so I spent a lot of time on the ground, under floors, helping to install floor furnaces. I also worked at a clothing store where the gentleman who owned it allowed me to have clothes at his cost so I could wear them to school and perhaps entice other young men down to the store to buy some for themselves.
Oh, it worked out for the both of you.
It did. I had tailor-made suits. When I got into college, I needed a tuxedo. My father was a professional musician, and he said, son, when you buy a tuxedo, if you could buy one for $15, buy it, because in the light where you're going to be wearing it in nightclubs, nobody will know whether it's a $100 tuxedo or a $15 tuxedo. However, because of my association with that store, I did indeed have one tailor-made.
Oh, that was a bargain.
It certainly was.
So, what level of education did you receive before you entered the Navy?
I was sitting one day in a grocery store across the street from the school with a group of friends. One of them said, my best friend, as a matter of fact, said, when I graduate, and he was a senior, I was a junior, he said, when I graduate, I'm going to enlist in the Navy. And I said, well, if you do, I will too, thinking that he wasn't going to do that, but he did. And so I had to also. So I quit school at the end of my junior year and enlisted in the Navy.
And then after your time in the service, you went on to college? And
I did.
Well, that's good. You picked up where you left off.
I went to college, and of course, I was given credit for, I think when I left school at the end of my junior year, I only needed another class or two to complete my senior year anyhow, because I had done accelerated work. So that was granted to me by, as a result of having served in the Navy.
Well, that was good. That was good on their part.
Yeah.
And are you still employed, or have you retired?
I retired in the following the spring semester of 1992.
Okay. And what level did you teach? Did you teach on the high school level or at the college level?
I taught at every level.
Oh, at every level.
Yeah. I started out with a job here in Missouri. In fact, I've had rather interesting geographical experience as a teacher. I began teaching in Elvins, Missouri, which is about 80 miles south of St. Louis. I left Elvins after 2 years and traveled to New York City to enroll in Columbia University. While there, my wife became pregnant with our first daughter, and we left at the end of one semester, returned to Missouri, where I worked the rest of the year, and then went to California to teach. I taught in California for 3 years, and then I came back to Crystal City, Missouri, which is about 40 miles south of St. Louis. And from Crystal City, I moved south to the little college where I finished my teaching career. So in order to get from the town of Elvins, which is about 8 miles from where I'm sitting right now, I left Elvins, went to New York, came back to Missouri, went to California, and wound up here 8 miles away from where I started.
That's a little bit of globetrotting.
It's the scenic view.
Well, you know, if you take the direct route, you don't get to see very much.
No, that's true.
So you had your first child when you started teaching again, or when you went back to college. So how many more children did you have?
In the first marriage, I had one daughter. And in my second marriage, which I'm still enjoying, we have a son, also named Michael.
And does your current wife, did she have any children before the two of you married?
She did. She had a daughter. We have a lovely stepdaughter who lives here in town, who is the mother of two grandchildren, one boy and one girl.
Wow, fantastic. So were you living in Metropolis, Illinois when you entered the service?
I was.
Okay. And you said it was at the end of your junior year, so you were what, 17?
Yes.
Okay. And as you said, you volunteered to enter into the Navy.
I did.
Okay. And that was because the friend of yours, not only did he enlisted in the Navy, so you decided to follow into the Navy as well.
That's exactly right.
Okay. Okay.
And the Greyhound bus line served Metropolis, Illinois, as it did many, many places in those days. And once a week, there'd be a Greyhound bus that would leave on which all the departing servicemen would ride. And on the day David and I left to go to Springfield, Illinois, for our induction services, we had all of our friends and relatives down there to see us off as if we were leaving for Mortal Kombat right away. We went to Springfield, and we spent the night there, and David and I were, typical children in those days, very curious about all sorts of things. And we got out the night we arrived in Springfield. We were housed and allowed to do whatever we wished to do, and we just had such a big time walking about and gawking and staring at the huge metropolis that was Springfield, Illinois, the capital. I don't know what the population was then, but it might have been maybe 15,000. To us, it was New York City. We had a great time there, and if you don't mind, I want to tell you about the next day.
Okay.
We were awakened early, of course, because with our first experience with the Navy. We were given a breakfast at a commercial cafeteria, and then we were taken for a physical examination, and I've laughed about this so many times. We were taken into a room which had, as I remember it, benches around the periphery of the room, and these benches were marble and cold as the dickens. We were told to undress, and a sailor entered the room with a metal tray in his hand in which were nested small bottles, and we were asked to make a donation into those bottles. And having sat there on a cold marble, I was wishing for maybe one gallon sized. But some of my friends had difficulty in doing that, so I made a donation for them. And the United States Navy owes me a great debt of gratitude because there were four or five young men that day who got into the Navy being as a result of my largesse in making donations for them.
And what year was this? What was the year when you entered in the Navy?
1944.
Okay. And where did you go for your boot camp?
Great Lakes.
Okay. That would be in Chicago.
Yes.
Okay. And what did you think of your time in boot camp?
Well, it was understanding that I had no reference point. I had no way of knowing whether I was being well-treated, well-trained, or not, but I certainly remember having no objections to it. I know this, when I went in, as we were all given physical examinations, and 9 weeks later when we graduated, I was in a lot better shape than I was when I had arrived there.
And after your time at boot camp, did you go to any kind of advanced training?
We were sent to Virginia. What's the naval base there?
I believe Norfolk.
Norfolk, right. We were sent to Norfolk to do 3 months mess hall duty. That was done in order to allow our ship, which was then building, to be completed, the one we were assigned to, the Frankie Evans. And the first day we arrived there, we settled into the barracks where we were going to be housed, and then we went to the mess hall to meet the officer in charge of that thing. And he said to us that you're going to be here 3 months. During the 3 months, or during this first month, one of you is going to work harder than all the rest. And the second month, that individual will be made assistant master at arms. And the third month, he will become master at arms. And that sounded like a pretty good deal to me, so I decided to make an effort to get that done, and I succeeded. The second month, I was assistant master at arms. And concurrent with that, there was a new crew that arrived, most of whom were from Brooklyn. And they had a sense of humor that was unmatched in my young life up to that point. And they were a rather difficult group to deal with because they were so playful. Much preferred playing with each other, jokes and that sort of thing, to doing the work they were supposed to do. So I had a rather raucous second month there. But I got through that in the third month as master at arms. It was my responsibility to tell the assistant what it was I wished to have done and let him worry about all the work that took place on the line with dishing food and then the washing of trays and utensils and that sort of thing. It was an interesting experience.
I would think so. And how professional do you believe, or at least in your opinion, how professional would you say that the instructors were?
Well, again, with no reference point, other than the exposure that I had, I had no reason to complain about anything that I was to which I was exposed. I thought they all did a good job. It was, of course, a different experience between civilian life as it existed then and military life. However, I had the advantage of having been reared by a very stern mother, so I already had an understanding of discipline. Furthermore, I began to understand immediately that the military is going to function much better if it's not run on the basis of a union. That when somebody tells you to jump, and you better do it because there's a good reason for doing it. And I still have some adherence to that notion.
So what was your daily routine during boot camp?
You know, that's going to be difficult to remember, but
okay.
We got up early before sunrise. One of our company had been appointed to lead the exercise. We would go out onto what was called a grinder and get in some kind of formation, and the instructor was on an elevated platform, and he would yell out what we were going to do, and then we would do it. And we would exercise like that for, gosh, I don't remember how long, maybe 30 minutes. Then we'd go back into the barracks, get cleaned up, and leave for breakfast. After breakfast and straightening the barracks, we would go to various classes. No, I'm sorry. We would go out then and stand for inspection. And there somebody would look over all the companies that were lined up and probably give us some general announcements for the day. For example, I can remember the day when I heard somebody say, today is the day you're going to get your uniforms, because we were issued a uniform when we first came in, and some of them had to be tailored, and so we were without a change of clothes for some days. Then after the assembly and inspection, then we would go to various classes, learn to tie knots or work on airplane or ship recognition or any of the various items of that sort that they wished us to know about.
Okay. And then we would have
lunch. And afternoons, I think I remember that we had probably more classes in the afternoon, but I'm not clear about that at all.
Okay.
I know there was a time during the day when we were permitted to have some time. That may have been the early evening to do things like our laundry and personal hygiene and et cetera.
At that time, did the Navy begin training you for a particular job aboard ship?
You know, I'm unclear in my mind about when that took place, but I think it was in conjunction with Norfolk.
Okay.
That we were given a generalized test, and my musical abilities were great enough. Oh, by the way, another thing I should tell you. When I first got into a company at Great Lakes, the question was asked, does anybody here play a drum? And I said, I do. So they said, you're going to be the company drummer. So I had a pretty good sense of rhythm. I played in the band, was a company drummer, and I also sang in the Great Lakes Naval Choir while I was in boot camp. So when I took the generalized test at Norfolk sometime later, for some reason, they could determine that I had a good sense of rhythm, and they decided that I needed to be a radioman, which worked out really well, because to learn that, you have to learn the Morse code, and the Morse code was sent by a machine which came across very rhythmically, and it was rather simple for me to pick up. So I did that, and I became one of the radio operators aboard the ship.
Okay. During your time in basic training or in boot camp, do you remember any particular incidents involving any individuals, unusual individuals or any unusual occurrences?
I do. We had a fellow from Illinois who. I don't know what his background had been, but he was not oriented towards cleanliness, and we could never figure out for sure exactly what his plan was, whether it was a determined thing on his part or just, and if you will excuse this expression, some kind of abject ignorance. But he would he would have some of the bodily functions take place while he was clad, and rather than clean those clothes, he would just wad them up, put them in his sea bag. And of course the aroma began to be rather telling, and the first experience he had was what was called a GI bath. Some of the guys grabbed him and took him in the shower and scrubbed him with one of those hard bristled brushes. And that didn't get the job done. I had to just cut this short. Eventually, he was discharged before he ever got out of boot camp as being unfit.
I would think so.
Yeah.
So, aside from the, as your story would indicate, self-discipline on the part of the men in the unit itself, at least enforcing discipline. How would you, or what were your impressions of the discipline on the part of your instructors?
Retrospectively, my impression is that they made every effort to make us understand when they wanted something done, when they gave an order, they wanted it done right now. We don't stop to talk about this. You have been given an order. Do it. And I think it was an effort to bring everybody into the same behavioral canoe, so to speak, so that we all understood that when an order was given, it was given for a good reason, and we didn't need to spend any time trying to determine whether it was reasonable or any other considerations, but to carry out the order. So I think their discipline was a little bit, certainly by today's standards, harsh. By harsh, I mean it was clearly understood that if you don't do this, there's going to be some kind of punishment. We didn't always know what the punishment was going to be, but they were rather creative. So it was determined rather early that these things we need to do without question. Just go do them.
During your time in training, was anyone ever injured or wounded?
No.
Okay.
Not to my memory.
Okay. So did you?
We were scared to death several times.
So did you volunteer for duty in the Pacific, or did you simply receive orders?
We received orders.
Okay. And when you told your friends and your family, what did they think of it?
Well, I didn't tell my friends and my family for a couple of reasons. The primary one being that we had been indoctrinated to believe that, you know, you tell your parents about this and then they will tell Lunch Bucket Harry at the grocery store, who happened to have a cousin who lives in Germany, and so we don't want to tell about troop movements of any sort.
Absolutely. So whenever you would write home during your time in training, you would just tell them, I'm in training.
Yes. Well, they knew it when I was at boot camp where I was and what I was doing. So nothing there, but with specificity in referring to going to the Pacific, no, I never said anything to them about that. In fact, my mother got angry at me one time because I hadn't written enough. And she got in touch with the Red Cross because she didn't know how else to get a message to me or to my superior to see that my letter writing became a little more disciplined.
So during your time in the Pacific, you were assigned to what fleet?
The 7th Fleet.
Okay. And during that time, your mission was related to combat or combat support?
I would say combat support.
Okay. During your time aboard Evans, what campaigns or battles were you involved in?
The only one of any consequence that I can remember was at Okinawa, and we arrived at Okinawa pretty well after the island had been secured. I think there may have been a few Japanese left about there. But the Battle of Okinawa, which was hellacious, as I understand it, was essentially over by the time we got there. And our job then was to, just to be sure, was to leave Okinawa and sail towards Japan across the horizon so that the radar aboard our ship would have an advantage over the land-based radar in terms of intercepting approaching hostile aircraft. So we patrolled back and forth out there, and I cannot remember how long, but maybe a couple of weeks, and then we would go back in and three more ships would come out to patrol, and we would come in for stores, food and ammunition if we needed any.
Okay. Speaking of ammunition, what was your impression of Evans and its equipment and weapons?
Well, my impression, these things are... My impression at the time was that we were told that the Evans would be misperceived by the Japanese as a cruiser. It was a modernized version of a destroyer at that time. There were 2 5-inch turrets forward and one aft. There were several 40-millimeter anti-aircraft guns. There was a whole array of depth charges on the aft section of the ship. And I think the captain had a rifle. I remember that because he used to shoot at sharks.
He used to shoot at sharks?
Yeah, when we were on shakedown cruise, the ship too, and the captain, if we were in shark-infested water, the captain would get out his rifle and shoot at them.
Was this to distract the sharks by getting their attention focused on one that was wounded, or did
no,
do this for
just,
sport?
I think it was a matter of sport, and the crew got a kick out of it, and so it had no militaristic implications at all. It was just a way of spending a little bit of time and letting everybody relax some on that shakedown cruise.
During your time aboard...
By the way, one other thing I need to tell you.
Sure.
That shocked me at the time. Either before we went aboard the ship or soon after we got aboard it, we were advised that a 30-30 rifle could probably shoot through the hull of that vessel from 100 yards. That was not a very comforting piece of information.
I would think not.
It looked and felt so sturdy, but I guess, and I'm sure it was as sturdy as they could economically build them in those days.
So during your time aboard Evans, do you remember seeing any actions either on the part of Allies or on the part of the Japanese that were particularly brave?
Particularly what?
Brave.
Brave?
Brave.
Brave. No, I don't.
Okay. Did you or the Evans, for that matter, have any kind of contact with coastal surveillance?
You know, I was interested in that question because I'm not exactly sure what that is.
Okay. Okay. Anything such as coast watchers or anyone?
No.
Okay.
Not
so,
to my knowledge.
Okay. Okay. During
you got to understand that I was a radioman, and I never spent any time. I was never told that I needed to be curious about what was going on in the radar room or what the officers were planning or what the messages were or orders were that came to the ship. I was a radioman, and that was my focus. So I'm sure if I were in the Navy today, I would have a lot more general information than that we were given in those days.
You focused on your job, and that was it.
That's about it, yeah.
So then what was your daily routine like aboard ship?
I'm hazy on that. I think, as I can remember, we often, quote, fell to, unquote, in the morning for some kind of inspection or announcements, and arose and had breakfast, and we had watch duties to stand. And I think in... the normal day would have been where we would sit for 4 hours and copy code, and then we would be off for 8 hours, and then we'd do another 4 hours. And when we were in what was then interpreted as combat situations, we would be on four, off four, on four, off four.
Okay.
I wish I could be a little more explicit about leisure time activity, but I just have no memory of that at all.
Okay. So when you were sitting on your watch and you were copying code, this could have been for incoming or outgoing messages?
Essentially incoming, and the reason for that is that I don't remember, except in and around the United States, the Evans ever sending messages. And of course the reason for that is when you bring your transmitters up and begin to send messages, those messages can be heard by everybody. And when those signals are sent out, the site of the sending can be essentially located. And had we, for example, sent out happy birthday messages to all of our mothers while we were floating around out in the Pacific, the Japanese could have found us because of the transmission. So we sent very few transmissions. Most of the communications that took place in the sense of sending took place surface to surface with either a light or flag signals.
Okay. After your shift was over on watch, what sort of things would you do whenever you had, what little free time that you did have?
Well, I think I mentioned that a while ago. I wish I had a greater memory of leisure time, but I do remember that I read, played cards. Other than that, and taking care of things like laundry, I just don't have any memory of leisure time.
Okay. So, in general, what were your living conditions on Evans?
The bunks were, well, first of all, at the deck or floor level, each bunk had a locker. There were three lockers under a bunk, under the bottom bunk. The fellow on the bottom had one of those lockers. The fellow in the middle bunk had a locker, and the fellow in the top bunk had a locker. And, other than that and the fact that we had the ample shower and personal hygiene conditions, and I found it very comfortable. I just had no problems with anything that we were given.
Well, especially since, as you had mentioned earlier, that in your childhood you didn't have running water or electricity, so this must have been quite a different experience.
Oh, I remember being. I can still. There are two scents, S-C-E-N-T-S, that I remember from the Navy. One was the general odor that surrounded all the places where we trained that had any electronic equipment in it at all. There was just a kind of a laboratory aroma that surrounded all that stuff. And the other one is not a sense of smell, it's a sense of taste. I learned to taste what fear was like, and I can remember it to this day.
Did you have a particularly frightening or memorable experience aboard ship?
I did. And we all did. On one of those returns to Okinawa, And let me preface this by saying I have seen Saving Private Ryan. I've talked with some of the men who went through those experiences, and the experience that I had is child's play compared with what they experienced, so I don't mean to elevate this in any sense at all. On one of our returns to port from doing a radar patrol between Okinawa and Japan, we had just gotten in and docked. We were called general quarters and sent back out to the same spot because a destroyer that had replaced us had been sunk, as I remember it.
Okay.
We sailed back out, three of us, one ship in the lead that I don't remember. The Evans was in the middle, and there was a third ship behind us. By this time, my general quarter station was the emergency radio shack, which was on the main deck of the ship. We were all, of course, advised to put on life vests and life belts and life vests, one or the other, or maybe both. An old salt by this time, I didn't deem that necessary, so I went into the emergency radio room and I cranked up the transmitter and the receiver. When I had those on frequency and operating, I went back out on the deck, and I was standing there with my foot up on a rail, looking ahead and watching explosions in the air where ships were firing at an airplane, or at airplanes. Unbeknownst to me, the radar had picked up a plane, a Japanese kamikaze, that was coming in on the ship behind us. Our forward 5-inch mounts turned around and began to trail the ship, and they fired at it. And the flame from that fire shocked me so, and it blasted me back against the bulkhead of the ship. And my next memory is being inside the emergency radio room, and I had on a life belt and a life vest. The doors, the two hatches that I'd entered to get into there were snugly fastened, and I have no memory of having done any of that, but I do remember how frightened I was.
Amazing.
And I became aware of, it's like I was conked out or something, and I'm sure I wasn't, but I think I was just scared to death. But I remember, I have no memory of opening either one of those hatches to get in there, and no memory of putting on either one of those life preservers. But I had the belt on, it was inflated, and I had the vest on, and it was fastened up tight, and I had this terrible taste in my mouth.
And
that's the only time that I had anything like.
And as you said, you could still taste that.
I can, yes.
Incredible.
Yeah, it's interesting that that's the part that I remember most vividly is the taste. But I also have other tastes in my mouth now, like a good fillet and things of that sort.
Much more pleasant things.
Yes.
So during your time aboard Evans, did you ever make any use of rest and recreation facilities?
No.
Okay. Did you ever...
I'm presuming that you're talking about a facility that was there for rest and recreation where service people would go for a period of time to rest and relax, right?
Well, it could be either a proper facility, or it could be any place where you pulled into port for the purposes of rest and recreation.
No, I don't remember any of those, but I remember a few times when we'd pull into port The rest and recreation that I can remember is one occasion, I don't even remember where we were, but somewhere in the Pacific where we were allowed to swim off the ship in some little, I don't remember anything else being around, but it was a place that the captain deemed to be safe for swimming. We were allowed to swim, and I think they had Coca-Cola aboard ship, and they gave us all Cokes but just to go into a port for that purpose, no, I don't have any remember of ever having done that.
Okay. Since you were aboard Evans from the beginning, as it were, on your trip to the Pacific, did you stop off in Cuba?
No, I think when we left the Brooklyn Navy Yards headed for the Pacific, I think that was a direct trip.
Okay.
I believe we were in Guantanamo on shakedown cruise.
Okay.
But I'm unclear about that. I remember we were in Bermuda, and I don't know whether that was a shakedown cruise, and I have no memory of that.
Okay.
We were at Guantanamo at one point, and we were in Bermuda at one point, but I can't remember the particulars.
Okay. So when you were when you were aboard ship, you did say that you wrote, especially after your mother made efforts to remind you to write more often.
Well, I wrote a lot of letters. I just hadn't written very many home.
Okay. Did you get many responses to your letters?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. I should tell you that when we left Brooklyn, we copied messages in code. The messages came across in 5-character segments. For example, S-R-K-Y-P. That would be one group. And the next one might be whatever, 5 letters. Everything came across in 5-letter groups. And when we first started to learn code, we listened to that, and we were asked to copy down the first letter of each group. And then to speed it up, the first 2 letters of each group until we could copy all the message. With the East Coast, by the time we were involved, the war in Europe had essentially ended, and we were focused on Japan. And on the East Coast, messages were sent at the rate of 8 groups a minute. Now, that's rather slow. But as we went down and went through the Panama Canal, the closer we got to the Pacific Ocean, the faster this thing speeded up. And the fastest messages we took were, of course, out in the towards Guam and Okinawa. By the time I reached that area, I could copy code as fast as I could type, and I could read a book or carry on a conversation while I was doing that and never miss a character.
Amazing.
The messages all came with, well, again, there were guys that could do it faster than I could, I sure, but the fastest messages we listened to would be messages that came from maybe a directive from the admiral about something to do within the fleet, some movement or something he wished to have done. Those were sent by an operator by hand on what was called a bug. And a bug is a device that you move laterally back and forth from one side to the other. One side will give you dots and the other side will give you dashes. And, of course, dots and dashes made up the Morse code which we were using then. Everything's sent in code, and each message had an address on it. Excuse me. And the Navy used a lot of abbreviations. Two that I remember, one was NERK, N-E-R-K, and that meant this is a message addressed to any and all ships in the Pacific Ocean. That was to address all of us. And that might have to do with something like location of buoys or some explosives had been discovered in the water but unexploded. The Navy also made use of signals for radioing. One I remember was QBK, and QBK was rather an insulting order. If you were in communication with another ship and you had trouble understanding their transmission, you would send QBK, and that meant put a competent operator on the radio. So that's the one we liked the best, but we didn't get a chance to use very often. So these messages would come in, and we copied everything, whether it was addressed to us or not. And when one came across, it was addressed to us, and I can't remember our call, but when one came across like that, we copied it and immediately took it out of the typewriter and carried it to the communications officer, who took it into a room where he had a decoder. He would decode it and then take it on to the captain. We never saw the results of the decoding. Anything we needed to know, we would then be told. So that's the way that operation took place.
Amazing. And it's impressive that you were able to do more than one thing while you were working on the code.
Well, not when you think about it. A good carburetor man can take a carburetor apart and carry on a conversation at the same time and do both successfully. One became such an ingrained process that it was almost habit. The other, carrying on a conversation, you'd have to think about what you were doing, but your subconscious would still hear. And this was not unique to me. Almost all the operators could do that.
Okay. So it became second nature.
Sure.
Okay. As most people know, the Germans, for example, used a naval code to encipher their messages. Did you have to encipher or decipher any messages?
As an operator, no, we didn't.
Okay.
That was always done by a communications officer.
Okay. So did you receive messages that were enciphered, then you handed them to him to decipher?
Yes.
Okay.
If a message came in addressed to us specifically, we would take it to the communications officer, either the assistant or the ensign or the lieutenant communications officer, and one of them would take it into a decoding room, decode it, and then take it forward to the captain.
Okay.
They never gave it back to us. By the way, do you happen to have contact with Jerry Fine, F-I-N-E?
I did, but unfortunately he passed away within the past couple of weeks.
He did?
Yes.
Well, I'll be darned. Well, I'm glad I asked you. I've been in touch with him a couple of times, and he was one of our communications officers. Well, I hate to hear that.
And fortunately, from what I understand from his family, it was fairly peaceful.
Well, good. When I got in touch with him, we could back up on my teaching experience a little bit. My first teaching job was in Eldon's, Missouri. And then I came back to Deloge, Missouri, and then I moved out to California. And then I came back to Missouri to a town called Crystal City. There I had as a student a young man named Bill Bradley. Bill Bradley was an exceptional basketball player and student. When he graduated from high school, he went to Princeton, where he was an All-American basketball player. When he left Princeton, he was a Rhodes Scholar, and he went to England and took a law degree. When he came back, he played professional basketball with the New York Knickerbockers for, I don't know, several years. When he left the Knicks, he ran for Congress and was elected a senator from the state of New Jersey. And during this last presidential campaign, you will remember he was one of the candidates, Democratic candidates for president.
Yes, yes.
And when I spoke with Lieutenant Fine, he was in New Jersey and told me that he'd had an office in the same building with Bradley, so we had a kind of a connection there.
So, what did you think about your experiences aboard the Evans at the time that you left the ship?
At the time I left the ship, I was so glad to get out of the Navy. And I will stick in here right now. There have been many times when I wish I had stayed in the Navy because the expectations I had for civilian life led me eventually to the conclusion that the military was right. Now, what I mean by that is this. When I get out of the Navy, nobody's going to tell me what to get up. Nobody's going to tell me what to wear. But I found when I became a civilian that if the Navy was not imposing those things, I had to impose them on myself. I could not, for example, go forth nude. I had to dress. If it was raining, it was sensible to wear something to protect myself from the rain. If I had a class at 8 o'clock in the morning, it was wise to get up and get there on time. So there really is not all that much difference. And I always had a feeling for the military. I have no idea now, thinking back on it, why I was so eager to get out. But I was so eager that I refused to keep the insurance, which is one of the great mistakes of my life. I can't remember what the premium was, but it was less than $1 a month for $10,000 of life insurance. And I dropped it. And the guy said, well, what do you want to drop this for? And I said, because I don't want you to have any way to get me back in here. So I can't square those two things up, my strong feeling for the military and the fact that I want to get out. I charge it up to youth and a certain degree of ignorance, or the inability to recognize what I thought was good and virtuous at the time.
So when did you leave the Navy? Did you leave in 44 or 1946?
46.
Okay.
And I believe I got out in June, and I started a college in the fall, and I cannot begin to tell you how grateful I am for having had the opportunity to go to college, because had it not been for the GI Bill, it would never have happened.
So were you recalled when the Korean War, or at least when the United States became involved in the Korean War?
No.
Okay. So how have your attitudes about your time in the service, have they changed in any way?
I spend very little time thinking about it unless I'm talking to somebody like Harold Higginbottom, that I'm sure you have on your list, or
yes,
one of the other guys. But I have nothing but positive remembrances. I'm sure there were things at the time that were misunderstood or misperceived as being virtuous in my life, but retrospectively, I have no arguments at all with anything that took place in my life during my time in the Navy.
When you were in the Navy, did you collect any kind of souvenirs during your time in service?
I think I have one picture. Did I send that to you?
Yes.
Okay. I have that one picture of me and my friend Charles Townsend and the fellow Sneddon. I don't remember what his first name was. No. When I got discharged, again, I was so anxious to get discharged that I allowed the larceny that entered into my soul at that time to be set aside, because I really wanted to bring home one of those automatic 45 pistols. And a lot of guys were taking them with them, but I just knew, in spite of the fact that I'm Irish and I was born on St. Patrick's Day, I didn't think my luck would hold there. Somebody would surely feel that in my sea bag and put me in prison for 40 years. So I didn't dare take the chance.
So, do you have anything else which you'd like to comment or discuss?
Nothing that I can remember except to say I have admitted to certain lapses of memory here, and I will freely admit that anything I may have told you might have been clouded by the lapse of time between now and when those things took place, but I've tried to be as honest as I could be, and I'm appreciative to the university for housing the archives relating to this in connection with the Vietnam War. Other than that, nothing that I can think of to say further.
Okay. Well, I thank you very much for your time this morning, and I hope you have an excellent day.
Well, best to you, too, and I appreciate what you're doing. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.